So my guest today is Sabina Leonelli. Sabina is an associate professor at the Department of Sociology, Philosophy, and Anthropology at the University of Exeter. She serves as the co-director of the Exeter Center for the Study of Life Sciences, also known as EGENIS, where she leads the data studies research strand. Her research covers the history and philosophy of biology, science and technology studies, and general philosophy of science, and currently focuses on the philosophy, history, and sociology of data-intensive science, especially the research processes, scientific outputs, and social embedding of open science, open data, and big data. And from 2014 to 2019, this work is being supported by an ERC starting grant on data science. I'd just like to welcome you to the show, Sabina.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
So I invited you to participate in this conversation because I think your work both overlaps with and differentiates from the work that I'm doing as part of this project. So my project is really focusing on the political uses of data and the political consequences of surveillance and big data systems and how they create new governance structures and what this means for core political and legal values. Now, you're really focusing on data in original scientific research. Nevertheless, I think your work draws out some interesting kind of connections with the work that I'm doing, and I hope we can focus on some of those connections and differences today. So I thought we'd break this discussion up into three main sections, starting with the impact of big data in scientific inquiry, and maybe, if we have time, ending up discussing some aspects of the open science movement. So let's start just by talking about the role of big data in modern science, and particularly in modern biosciences, which I know is your focus and speciality. So there's a lot of talk nowadays about of big science, and this seems to have gone hand in hand with the rise of big data. Some people seem to think that big data threatens to revolutionize the scientific method. I think in particular here of the arguments put forth by Kukier and Meyer Schoenberg in their book on big data. So are these proponents of big data, are they right? Is there more hype than reality to this notion that big data threatens to revolutionize science? So I just wanted to maybe explore those ideas at the outset. We'll get into some of your critical reflections on that in a moment, but first let's talk about how science works traditionally and what might be new with big data science. How does the scientific method work traditionally? What's the traditional understanding of the scientific method?
Well, I suppose it's a little bit difficult. Thank you, John, for this. It's a little bit difficult to talk about traditional understandings without getting into, if you want, could be a critique of the ways in which people have talked about big data, at least in some environments, because typically, you know, some constructions of big data are very much predicated on very particular construction about what traditional scientific methods are supposed to be.
Sure.
And which, of course, is quite complicated. I mean, you know, most of my work is devoted to look at different ways in which researchers in different fields, and specifically in biology, are working and dealing with data. And really, like in history, these have come in very multiple forms. So it's very difficult to give you a one story about how people have dealt with data, because that actually wouldn't really be true to the history of science, across the sciences and in biology. And I would say, you know, very often a story given by big data proponents is that science typically has operated as hypothesis formation, and then exploring a certain hypothesis, testing it by producing particular data sets, and then deciding to accept or reject the hypothesis depending on which data sets you get. This kind of conception has been very strongly critiqued in philosophy of science for a number of reasons. First, certainly there are projects which are very much about trying to explore an hypothesis. But first of all, in many cases, it's not really clear, you know, the hypothesis is very badly defined. Mm. And it becomes more and more precise as people actually produce more data, interact with the world in a variety of ways, and then get to reflect more and more on what particularly is the phenomenon they really want to study. So that's already one interesting question, whether it's really clear what people mean when saying that they have an hypothesis they want to test. And also there is a very strong tradition in criticizing the notion of testing itself. So, you know, a lot of work in history of science has shown that even if you're interested in a very specific hypothesis, there is no obvious way in which a set of data or a set of evidence will confirm or disconfirm that. This is still a matter of actually putting together an argument where you're showing in which way a certain set of evidence may be for or against the claim that you're trying to prove. And there's been a lot of discussion around things like underdetermination, the fact that the same data set can be interpreted in lots of different ways, depending on your conceptualization of reality and the instruments you're using. So again, I would say there is a traditional expectation that the scientific methods is about finding an interesting question, going off in the world, use wonderful methods, and then coming up with an answer. But I would say the reality of it is much more complex and, you know, still very sophisticated, but actually not exactly so linear. And that is part of the issue we're trying to explore, we're thinking about big data. So there is an intuition that suddenly having more comprehensive, larger data sets can actually give you better confirmation for certain hypotheses and therefore give you much easier access to knowledge and to proving knowledge claims. And the question is whether that's really the case when one takes into account the fact that actually there's a lot of work going into showing how certain data can function as evidence for particular claims.
I appreciate that the kind of linear understanding of the scientific method is not necessarily reflective of how the sciences work in practice. But just to dwell on that kind of traditional image for a moment, even maybe it's wrong to call it traditional, but this stereotypical image, let's say, like data within that traditional image is kind of the results of the experiment. Would that be the results of the hypothesis testing? That's what scientific data means in the context of that linear picture of the scientific method.
I mean, I guess, yeah, I mean, that would probably be one way to understand it, that data are the results of a set of operations, which is put in motion by people trying to pursue a particular question.
Yeah, I suppose the question I'm asking then is, like, is there a distinction between data and the theories or the explanations of data? Or is it a much more kind of fuzzy and fluid boundary between those two things?
Well, I mean, of course, this is one of the big philosophical questions. I mean, does it even make any sense to have something like science, given that anything we may try to explore, even in science, is so-called theory-laden? So the expectations you may have and the conceptualization of the world you have will color the way in which you set up your experiments and the kind of data you get. And of course, the typical answer to this is, of course, it makes a lot of sense to do scientific research because we've actually accumulated in time very sophisticated methods to elicit certain kinds of evidence from the world. And the fact that you're actually interacting with material objects, which will offer resistance, will do whatever they want, in a sense. You don't know what's going to happen when you're setting up an experiment. You have certain expectations, but those can prove to be wrong. The data you collect may just not match the expectations you have. This process, repeated over time, guarantees the fact that you actually have an empirical foundation to your knowledge, which is not just about you sitting in a corner and thinking about what you think the world should be like, but is constantly tested against what the world actually is like and how it responds when it's probed in particular ways.
Yeah, so the method is kind of an iterative one where our understanding of what the data is refined through this process of experimentation and testing against empirical reality.
Yeah, and I think it's very important to acknowledge the fact that one of the strengths of scientific methods is that they're multiple. There's many methods that can be used to produce data for the same claim. And typically, trying to triangulate different sources of evidence and produced in different ways with different instruments is one of the strongest ways that scientists have always had to try and think about whether the claim they're trying to make is true or not. Because, of course, if you're testing it through different instruments, so, you know, in the case of relationships between genetic makeup and certain phenotypic traits that an organism may exhibit, if you're seeing the same trend when you're doing sequencing analysis, when you're actually analyzing an organism in terms of the cell organization of the organism, and when you're looking at the behaviors that the organism have in the world, then chances are that your claims will be much more robust than if they're just based on one type of data.
Yeah, I mean, I think people can grasp that fairly intuitively if you think about, let's say, the kind of evidence that's collected to support a hypothesis that somebody committed a crime. You can have multiple strands of evidence that all point towards the same conclusion, like
exactly
fingerprints, yeah, and DNA and eyewitnesses. So they're all triangulating on the same result, and that's one of the great strengths of the scientific method. However, I just want to maybe underline one point here before we proceed to talk about big data from that, which I think is worth emphasizing, which is that data is both theory-laden in the sense that we use theories to interpret and understand data, and data is also underdetermines theoretical results or theoretical conclusions. Okay. Turning then to big data science, first thing, and I've asked a few people this question, and I'm always interested in the answer, what is big data, and what do you understand by big data?
Well, I mean, I'm actually rather happy to go with Rob Kitch's definition of the term. And so thinking about these as data which have a high volume, high velocity, in the sense that they're created very fast, and they're very diverse in variety. So it's the so-called 3Vs definition of big data. Now, this said, and I think this actually gives you a space which is very, very interesting in terms of thinking about this data. This said, I would say that to really think about what these big data are doing and how they're novel is important to actually really think about data in general, so-called small data, and how they may compare to this large data production.
Mm. So maybe could you talk about that, the similarities and differences between the small and the big?
Well, I would say that actually a lot of the data that many scientists are dealing with, which are sometimes then brought together in so-called big data collections, could count as something like small data. So very often what you're doing is actually still producing data which is of one particular type in any one experiment. And you may be doing it in a very fast way with a high throughput, but you know, what exactly that means, again, is not entirely clear. So, for instance, you can have a situation where you can produce trillions of data bytes or data points on genomic sequences in the space of a day right now, thanks to the technology available to do that. And this would be traditionally seen as big data. Or you can have a situation where somebody who's interested in studying the morphology, say, of particular plants for agricultural purposes, accumulates lots and lots and lots of very complex images of those plants. Now, those images would have to be categorized as small data, if you want, because they're not that diverse, they're not produced particularly fast, and they're not as high throughput as the big data definition requires. At the same time, they actually require huge amounts of labor, both in terms of actually applying the kind of algorithmic reasoning that you're interested in, but also in terms of really manually conceptualizing how to extract information for those data. And so, again, you know, that creates interesting issues around what does it mean to make a distinction between big and small data sets when one takes into account the amount of labor and amount of human decision-making and algorithmic power that goes into transforming data into knowledge, if you want, or like trying to work out how to use data as evidence for particular claims.
Yeah, I think that's interesting and important. That, I mean, the 3Vs framework can be both maybe helpful and misleading in terms of getting us to focus on different things. And if we're interested in the algorithmic power that goes into reaching conclusions or making decisions, we may not actually be talking about big data, strictly so-called, under that kind of 3V definition. I want to talk then just about how big data, however you might define it, will revolutionize the scientific process. So, you know, as I said, mentioned earlier, there are some people who are kind of cheerleaders for big data in science. They think that it will have this revolutionary potential. Could you maybe explain why people think that it will have this revolutionary potential?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's three key ideas, I think, that people have put forward when thinking about the power of big data. And this is particularly also in reference to the kind of argument that Meyer Schoenberger and Kukier have put out in relation to this, like, you know, how this is revolutionary, basically. Mm. So the first idea is that we have data sets which are more comprehensive than ever before. So the idea here is that we don't have any more to think about which kind of samples we want to privilege when collecting data. But in fact, we can collect so much data that it just covers the entirety of the phenomena that we're interested in. So for instance, when doing a study of a population which is subject to a particular kind of disease, we don't have to think in advance, okay, which individuals within that population should we examine and test and how does that sample relate to generalizations about the whole population, but we can just get data about everybody, put it together, and then you have something which is really comprehensive and doesn't run into the problem of then trying to sample in ways that may not be representative of the whole. So this is one of the big ideas. The second idea that seems to be the revolutionary idea about big data is the fact that you don't actually have to be quite as exact and precise in your data collection as people thought that you used to be. And so the idea here is that there are just so many data floating around about different aspects of people's lives, of the environment, that just by assembling all of these different data sources, you will still get more information than you would by being much more precise about the questions you're asking and the parameters you're using and only looking at the results, at data which results from investigations which are set up in that way. The third assumption or idea that people have put forward, which is very relating to that, is the fact that, in fact, because you have so much information about so many things, and this is not really exact information, but it still gives you a lot of scope for making generalizing claims about the way the world is, what you should be looking for is correlative claims rather than causal claims. The idea here being that it takes a lot of knowledge and a lot of different methodologies to really establish a causal claim. You know, the idea that something causes something else is actually a very, very difficult thing to establish conclusively. And in fact, it's very difficult to do, and very few people manage to do this. The most obvious case of this is in medical science, where there are lots of claims that actually, for instance, taking a certain drug causes a certain effect, or a certain biological mechanism causes a certain disease. But establishing those claims conclusively and in ways which can be relied upon is a matter of many, many years of study and a lot of money invested into making these studies. So the idea here is that actually, maybe we don't really need to worry about causal claims to that extent. All we need is if you want circumstantial evidence for two parameters being strongly correlated. So the idea is, well, if you have a lot of data that seems to indicate that whenever a certain substance is present in somebody's body, then certain symptoms happen, then you may be justified to say, well, the presence of that substance pretty much causes the symptoms. Whether or not you understand that this is a real causal claim, whether or not you understand the mechanism behind it, doesn't matter. All that matters is that you're getting a correlation. Now, the reason why these ideas are very important for big data is that in a situation where you're collecting data on such a large scale, you may well be able to generate a lot more correlations and based on many, many more data sets than you used to in the past. And if you accept this as a new way to produce scientific knowledge, which is accepted as such, then you can see the reason why people argue that this would be revolutionary for the sciences, because instead of doing very specialized, sophisticated studies, which are very careful about which kind of data you collect and for what reason, you can just do a lot of data collections, you can use a lot of the data which exists independently of research, for instance, data collected by government, data collected by insurance companies, data collected by corporations, and use those to be able to establish scientific claims. And I've actually been very critical of these claims, but this is more or less how people are discussing this.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it might actually be worth getting into some of the criticisms now, because this overlaps with some of my interest in terms of the political uses of data. I mean, an obvious point is that correlations often seem spurious. You can find links between different types of data that don't tell you anything meaningful or interesting about the world, or maybe reflective of let's say, deep biases or prejudices in the ways in which data is collected. I mean, I think about this in particular in the way in which, let's say, data might be used to decide who should get a lower insurance premium or who's a credit risk. So, you know, there's lots of scoring algorithms used in the financial sector. So, like, why is it a good thing to start collecting more and more correlations? I don't know. I don't quite see how that helps the scientific process if we just have lots and lots of spurious correlations or biased correlations.
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more. So that's actually part of the criticism I've also been writing about in thinking about this. And certainly, and I think thankfully, finding proper causal explanations is still very much a goal of scientific research, as opposed to just looking for correlations which may or may not be plausible and reliable in the knowledge that they give you. I think, I mean, most of my research actually has been focusing on, if you want, the methods through which people collect the data, but most importantly, how these data are assembled. So I've done a lot of work on data infrastructures, ways in which data are labeled and ordered and managed, algorithms used to digest the data, and ways in which the data are visualized and retrieved. One of the things that becomes very clear from doing a lot of empirical work on different cases of that sort is that there is actually a huge amount of bias introduced by all these different methods to collect data. This is for a variety of reasons, is partly because some data are much, much easier to produce, to digitally disseminate and to retrieve than others. And therefore, those data actually tend to completely overwhelm online repositories and the kind of places where people go to try and find large data collections. So certainly in biology, that's the case with sequencing data, which has taken a huge chunk of that landscape, simply because they're very, very easy to produce. They're indeed high throughput, and they can be very easily exchanged because they're already produced in a digital format. Now, what this means, the fact that there is a bias intrinsically on which data are most easy to disseminate and easy to retrieve, is that actually the collections that you're looking at typically, certainly within the sciences, are not nearly as complete as a lot of the big data advocates would pretend. In fact, there are huge biases in there, both in terms of the data types that are actually included, but also in terms of the samples which are used. So, you know, the obvious case here is the fact that the laboratories that are most visible, powerful, and rich in the developed world are typically the ones that are most involved in building data infrastructures and disseminating their data, because they have very little to lose and a lot to gain. I mean, they get even more visible, they get other people to adopt their data sets and get cited for it. And in a sense, they actually get to control that gain because they get to set the standards by which data should be disseminated and, in fact, to decide on which data should be most relevant in that sphere. So a lot of laboratories which are working on different populations, different topics, they're producing different kinds of data which are actually quite difficult to disseminate, maybe because the data files are very large or because there are very strong relationships with particular materials, for instance, biomedical samples, or people who work in parts of the world which don't typically have the resources to participate in this kind of digital enterprises. So they don't have the resources to put together databases, and sometimes they don't even have reliable broadband to be able to access this. All the data that these labs produce doesn't tend to be included in this kind of global databases. What that means is that you really don't have a complete set of data. But at the same, and that's actually, if it was just this, it would be fine, because of course you never quite, never in the sciences you had a complete set of data. You always have something which is quite partial. What is problematic and worrying, I think, with big data is the assumption that because there's just so much data, you don't have to worry about the bias anymore. It seems to me that it's almost the opposite. Now the bias is becoming so entrenched in these ways of disseminating and retrieving data that it becomes much more difficult to see. So if you have a study which is very specifically geared around the fact that your data sets will be limited, there will be problems in using it, the sample may not be fully representative, at least you can acknowledge that when you draw some conclusion from that study. In the situation we have now, the huge biases which are within data sets, certainly within the biomedical and more broadly the scientific realm, tend to be hidden and tend to become part of sort of black boxes where, because you rely so much on the technology, you start to question much less where data actually come from and which other data may be relevant but haven't been incorporated in these collections and therefore they're not really being analyzed.
Yeah, I mean, so you've said a lot there that is, I think, important and interesting, and I'd like to maybe just elaborate on it, because I know in one of your papers, and maybe in other ones as well, but the one that I read before this interview, you talk a lot about data journeys and how the data gets into these databases. And I know you've touched upon that there, but I think actually laying out the framework that you have for thinking about it would be useful. So you say that there are, well, first of all, you use a set of examples, which are these model organism databases in biosciences. Could you just maybe briefly describe those model organism databases? What are the model organisms that are typically used in biosciences?
Sure. So I've taken that example because I've been working for years on the history of this. And it's actually a very nice example of a set of scientific communities which are relatively consistent in bringing data together and thinking about what that means, which actually is quite exceptional. I mean, that doesn't happen often. But in this case, you have groups of people who really thought for a long time about how to collect data about a particular organism and the advantages of bringing together lots of different types of data to try and understand that organism. So model organisms in biology are particular species which have been chosen to as focal points, if you want, for lots of different research. The idea there being that even if those species are not fully representatives for lots of others, in some respects, is still very useful for scientists who work in different parts of biology. So for instance, in cell biology or in molecular biology or in physiology, in anatomy, in ecology, to focus on the same species, because that will mean that the data that you collect on that species, you will then be able to really integrate, which is already a very, very difficult thing. So focusing on one species gives you a tool to put together databases, resources, sampling, and of course, background knowledge that allows you to really think about, okay, so now if I know quite a few things about the genetic makeup of this particular species, about its physiology, about its anatomy, about its evolution, what does that mean in terms of understanding the organism as a whole? So examples of this, for instance, are Drosophila, so the fruit fly, which has been used really like from the beginning of the 20th century in biology. The zebrafish now is a very popular model organism in between biology and biomedicine. Mice are also rather popular model organisms in a variety of respects. And I'm doing a lot of work also on one organism which is very popular within the plant sciences, which is a little weed called Arabidopsis, which is a rather an interesting plant, if you want, except for the fact that there are thousands and thousands of researchers which are focusing on that as, if you want, as a representative for all other plants in some respect. Now, I've started to use the notion of data journeys in relation to try to reconstruct all the different ways in which people in these communities don't just produce the data, but in fact put a lot of effort into setting up structures and methods to process the data and disseminate them, so that ultimately they can actually do what this old model organism research really proposes to do, which is to integrate this data and to acquire overarching knowledge about these organisms. So it's a very sophisticated community in that respect. And the idea of a data journey is trying to supersede other metaphors which are typically used to think about data processing, such as, for instance, the one of data flows. This is quite popular. Lots of people use it also in journalism. And I think that's really problematic because it seems to imply that it's actually relatively easy for data to flow like water from one point to another in a system and to be accepted and to be reused and to be repurposed for a variety of ways. Now, when you're looking at something like model organism biology, and we are now extending that research to look at lots of other cases in other types of science, one of the things that becomes very, very clear is that when data is moved across different settings, that requires a very big amount of labor. And in fact, that data will not move and will not travel anywhere unless there are a lot of people with different expertise that come in and actually make it possible for data to travel by setting up appropriate infrastructures and formats and other ways of doing this. So the idea of data journey is to look at the ways in which data are originally produced, but then follow them, literally track them, as they move, for instance, into a particular data set, and then into a database, and then they're linked to another database, and then they're linked to yet another database, and then following them all the way to situations, which typically are multiple, where different researchers in different labs may be interesting, if you want, even in different questions, but may come across the same data set, which has at that point been processed quite a bit, and then be able to reuse it for their own purposes. So the journey really traces all the phases from production to dissemination to the reuse of data.
Okay, so maybe we could think about these data journeys using just, let's say, a simple example. So if you can imagine a scientist who's doing research on fruit flies or something, on, I guess, they're often used in genetic studies. So they've got a set of results showing how different crossbreeding affects phenotypic properties in in a population of Drosophila. That's some data and an experimental result. How is that data then taken and fed into these databases? Like you talk, there's three stages to this process, you say. So we start with a decontextualization phase. What does that mean to decontextualize the data from that original study or set of studies?
So the idea here is that typically when you produce the data, you have this idea that, in fact, unless you've really been part of the production of data, so you actually know exactly the conditions under which they've been produced, you know, the temperature of the room, the instrument you use and how you calibrated it, you're not really going to be able to understand the significance of those data as evidence. And that is actually meant in the past that people have put much less insistence in trying to circulate data as outputs in their own right. Because they were saying, well, the only way it makes sense to publish some data is in association to the particular claims that you're trying to defend. And the typical way to do that is within a scientific paper, when you're presenting a certain argument, and then you're showing which data could support that argument. The idea of decontextualizing is to actually just take the data that come out of a certain research environment and strip them from the knowledge that about which instruments were used, which pieces and which materials data were extracted from, et cetera, and really just get the data to circulate by themselves, which is a very interesting way to do this. And this is basically what a lot of database curators, people who are really trying to set up databases for biology, are in charge of doing, to be able to set up a system where data can be retrieved and searched for without having to worry about all the other information that may come with it about the conditions under which they're originally produced.
Yeah, and I mean, what are some of the kind of biases or problems that arise at this kind of decontextualization phase? What sorts of decisions have to be made?
Well, of course, I mean, and that's partly why I want to insist on that, because actually decontextualizing the data is means taking a lot of decisions about what parts of the data are really important to keep and what other parts of the data are actually less important in terms of their future use. Now, I should say that what's really important about decontextualizing data is the fact that eventually what you want to obtain, of course, is the data reused. And for data to be reused, they need to be recontextualized. That's the second part of the movement that I tend to discuss in my work. What that means is that if you're going to a database as a biologist and you want to get back those data about Drosophila you were discussing before, you may be interested in those data for very different reasons from the people that produced them in the first place. But still, typically, you'll be interested in trying to assess for yourself whether those data are reliable and how they could possibly be interpreted given the ways in which they've been produced. So at that point, if you want to recontextualize the data within your own research environment and your own questions, you actually want to be able to track back some of the information about the provenance of data that got discarded, if you want, when data were being decontextualized. So what does it actually mean for decontextualization is that the people who are in charge of that typically have to think very hard about what elements, which they call typically metadata, what information about the data needs to be retained and made available to people who actually retrieve the data through a database, so that they will actually be able to recontextualize it. So really what decontextualization means is a separation between data as material objects that need to travel and be retrieved by themselves, and the information about data and data provenance that people who decontextualize think may be useful to people who want to reuse the data. And this is where a lot of the interesting decisions happen. Because, for instance, one of the things I've been looking at in my work is the differences between people who are doing this kind of operation in relation to model organisms in biological labs, where the standards for the accuracy of the information you give about the conditions under which data were produced is very high. And therefore, for instance, it's absolutely obvious that one of the informations that everybody will want to have if they're interested in a certain data set is which organism it was actually taken from. Now, compare that with situations in clinical science, particularly the kind of clinical science which is done both on rodents and on humans, where actually, believe it or not, a lot of people who are recording those data in databases are much less interested in recording which species the data come from. And very often in the document, for instance, if you use a particular probe that comes from yet another species to generate whatever genetic effect they want to see or effect of gene expression, they don't actually signal that. What it means is that you have sometimes databases where you're bringing this kind of data together, and there's been different decisions made by people who decontextualize the data about what is most essential to know for people who reuse the data. So you may have a clinician that goes into the databases, sees lots and lots of data what pertains, for instance, to a certain genetic mutation, but only for some of those data, they will be able to trace back which species the data actually apply to. And while for others, it will just not be clear. So obviously, the ways and the decisions you make in decontextualizing the data and the labor that goes into making those decisions is very important, because it will directly affect the extent to which and the ways in which you can then reuse the data at the end of this process.
And I would like to draw out the parallels here with other uses of data. So people will be very familiar with the concept of metadata if they follow debates about surveillance and telephone metadata, mobile phone call metadata. And I mean, in all those, let's say, political uses of data about the citizens within a state, or the use of financial data by banks and other financial institutions, similar decisions are being made in those contexts, although there might be some differences. So, I mean, there are choices made about which kinds of data are relevant, which need to be, you know, scraped and taken from various, like, online databases or other repositories of financial information. And somebody somewhere along the line is making a choice as to what to prioritize and what to include within the database. And what you're pointing out is here in the construction of scientific databases, databases in biosciences, very similar sets of decisions are being made. Recontextualization then is you're trying to make the data useful to future researchers. Is that correct? That's essentially the idea behind the recontextualization phase.
Yes, I mean, the idea there is that the whole point of making data circulate in this way and creating these big data assemblages is the fact that you make it possible for people who have a different training from the people who have originally produced the data. They have different skills, they may have different expectations and different interests. You make it possible for those people to have a look at those same data. And precisely because of the difference in the backgrounds of these people, it's very likely that they will actually be able to use data differently. And so in that sense, they will be able to augment the value, if you want, of the data, because now you can put those data to different purposes, not just to one investigation, but to several. So the idea of recontextualization is that you want to maximize the extent to which people who have different backgrounds, who make different assumptions from the people who produced the data originally, can access the data and make sense of them. But at the same time, you need to be sure that you give enough information that this can be done appropriately and maintaining certain standards of quality and reliability of the data. Because, of course, it's then also very easy in those environments to produce correlations which are misleading, to produce claims which are based on bad data. I mean, there's a big problem right now in this process of decontextualization, which really relates also to data selection in the first place. So which data counts as good data? And which data is bad data. I mean, those decisions are being taken in these systems. And the big challenge for recontextualization efforts is how do we give people instruments to make decisions about not only how to use the data, but which of the data that they can retrieve is the best to use.
And I think you point out that the curators of these databases, they are making important kind of value judgments about the quality of the data. So they're playing a very key and decisive role, in the future of scientific discovery, at least to the extent that scientific discovery relies upon these databases of information.
Absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing is that in situations which have been always described as ideal, actually, these curators should be doing as little as possible in that sense. So the idea would be that they would consider themselves as very successful when they allow people who have the expertise and come in with particular expectations to make their own judgment on a good basis about whether data are reliable or not. So that would be the ideal situation. Of course, what is now happening, both because of the sprawling nature of these databases, where it's literally a castle of cards, where you're getting more and more and more nested databases that depend upon each other and build up broader and broader collections, but also because of the expectations that really these big data discussions are creating also in terms of scientific funding and in terms of government, that basically now expects that as long as you apply a data, big data approach, you will have very easily very big results in terms of generating knowledge. There is a very strong incentive for people to rely more and more and more on curators and databases to make that assessment of whether data are good or not, and then to just get on with the work. So even if in many cases curators are not very happy about this, they are increasingly pushed towards making decisions such as what they call the confidence with which data people should approach the data. So they usually, in many of the databases I'm looking at, different data sets get different degrees of confidence associated with them. And the idea would be that if this is data that comes out of a very well-known, very well-equipped lab that is known for doing good work, then this will be given a very high degree of confidence. So people can just go in there and don't spend any time wondering whether the data is good or not, but just take it at their face value. While in situations where data comes from a simulation, so is really hypothetical data, is not as strong as data that derives from physical interaction with the world and from an experiment, and maybe is done by laboratories which don't have a very strong reputation in their field, then those data sets will be given a lower degree of confidence, and people would automatically assume that these are a bit less reliable. I mean, and you can see in all of this, of course, things like automatic algorithms and different technologies used to compose these assemblages are very, very important. But at the same time, every time one of these technologies and algorithmic treatment is introduced, the possibility for human error is multiplied because you're assuming more and more and more about, you know, the data that are actually stored in these systems.
Yeah, I mean, I guess then it seems to really kind of problematize some of the original claims by like Kukier and Meir Schoenberger, because the assumption there is that like this is just, it's a messy, comprehensive assemblage of data. We're getting everything in, but in reality, we're not. We're getting particular kinds of things are being brought in based on what people judge to be of value and of worth. And so one argument or one concern I have about this in, let's say, a political context is that the value judgments and assessments that go into this process are often hidden from view, sometimes deliberately, by people who maintain these kind of algorithmic databases. Other times, maybe not deliberately, but people just aren't incentivized to be aware of the problems that arise. Is this true in science as well? I mean, are the biases and value judgments hidden from view? Do researchers not question it? Or is there a more kind of robust debate around the biases and value judgments that go into constructing these databases?
I would say similar mechanisms at play, and I've written quite a bit about that, as you know, I mean, I have similar interest in that sense to you. So I really do think there's a big political play around who gets to make these decisions. And the who is really important, both in terms of which specific researchers get to do this, but also which country they work in, which type of research they're doing, and therefore which kind of visibility that research gets vis-a-vis other research, and what kind of work gets funded. So on one end, I would say there is an attempt, certainly now with this whole replicability crisis and lots of other discussions around open data and open science, there is an attempt to make scientific processes as transparent as possible and to be reflexive about the kind of values and value judgments that go into fabricating these systems. And certainly that would be the case with respect to, say, the handling of governmental data, insurance data, financial data, where you know, there's a lot of work going into hiding what is actually going on. At the same time, you know, making things transparent, and again, that's something I'm very interested in and me and my colleagues have written quite a bit about, doesn't necessarily mean that you're actually eliminating the problem. And in fact, these very disparate power differentials and these the different games that you can play around how you organize the data are still completely there in the sciences. It's just that they may be more or less visible. People may be at least potentially interested in discussing them. But the fact is that at the end of the day, I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about science, of course, is that data are important and they're increasingly recognized to be very important to the scientific process. But ultimately, this is not what people are really aiming to have or to do, to produce data. What they want is to get knowledge out of that data. So data is a tool. And people will go to great lengths to make sure that they can actually use those data fruitfully to as evidence for particular claims. Now, what that means is very often, and partly also because a lot of the initiatives that go into decontextualizing and putting data online are very disparate and they're very disjoint, there's going to be lots of different, there's going to be a strong push for people to actually not really consider a lot of the ethical and social and political issues that go around putting out a certain data set or putting together a certain infrastructure. The push will be to really think about, okay, if I put together this algorithm and this particular database and this technology, what kind of science can I do? And one of the things that I've been trying to insist on is actually that ethical considerations and consideration about the potential impact of the kind of value judgments which are made when putting together these infrastructures are actually something that people should be looking at much more, partly because they're really part of the technical side of putting these things together, really thinking about how these collections could be expanded, which other data could be integrated to them, with which effect. But also because in many cases, some of the value judgments made in a situation which doesn't seem that problematic start to become problematic when you start to add more and more and more data which is treated in a similar way. And then you end up with a whole system which is making very specific assumptions. So, for instance, one case that for me is very obvious and rather worrying in many ways is the fact that within the biological and biomedical science, there is a lot of data integration that goes around particular genetic pathways. So particular ways in which genes are expressed that are seen to be giving rise to particular traits. But what is very interesting there is that a lot of the data that comes from some of the main model organisms around that has been extracted from organisms which have been standardized as healthy organisms, or as people sometimes call them, normal organisms, right? So the whole assumption behind it is that you're getting data about an organism which is in its full functionality. Again, whichever way you want to define that. Well, a lot of the medical data that are being compared to those data come from situations where you're explicitly looking for, if you want, abnormal, ill, non-fully functional organisms in some way. And a lot of assumptions go into treating these data and collecting them, which are then not re-examined when these big data sets are put together very often.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think that I agree with all of that, and I think the same kinds of problems arise in other contexts. I wanted to move on just to talk about the last stage, since we've touched upon it already to some extent, but we mentioned the two previous stages of the data journey, the decontextualization and recontextualization. The final phase then is the reuse phase. And one of the important points that you make, and I think it's worth kind of spelling it out here, is that very little data actually gets to this stage.
Yeah, I mean, that's for me always fascinating, because of course there's so much hype around open data and wide data dissemination. But, partly because people are actually still in very parts of the sciences a little bit hesitant about trusting these big data assemblages, partly for the reasons that we have now discussed. And also partly because it's actually quite difficult to repurpose research so that you can base it on secondary data analysis. Usually that comes also with producing some data yourself. Then you end up in a situation where very many people will tell you that accessing databases and being able to explore them has been very important to informing the research directions and the ways in which they want to set up the research, which of course is already very, very, very useful. But there's going to be very, very few cases, relatively speaking, within the sciences, where people have actually based a whole research project purely on the consultation of this data, and so therefore on secondary data analysis. And that's a very interesting thing because, at least in the ways in which some governmental agencies and funding agencies are thinking about big data, the idea really would be that we would want to give more and more money for data infrastructures and data dissemination so that we can give less and less money to the production of new data sets, because this will become less relevant because you can actually rely more on already existing data sets. But that doesn't really look like it's happening in the sciences. Certainly within biology, I would say, by and large, people may want to compare data that they produce with data which already exists. But the idea of actually being able to completely ground a research project only on data produced by others is really not taken hold at all yet.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things I maybe want to get back to there, but just one example that you have in your papers, that the kinds of data that do get to maybe to the reuse stage, I mean, one of the most popular forms is genetic data or genome sequences. Why is it that they're particularly susceptible to passing cleanly through the three, or maybe not cleanly, but passing through the three stages, whereas other kinds of data are not? What's unique and special about genomic data?
Well, genomic data are at least supposedly very simple. They come out of a very highly standardized process of production where, you know, at least as standardized as it can get, where the kind of machinery that you use to produce genomic data has been highly standardized. Actually, for a long time, it was produced by the same company, Affymetrix. So there was basically a monopoly on how genomic data were produced. This is now different, but still it sort of set the mode for that kind of data. And in a sense, you know, they are documenting something relatively simple, which is the order of amino acids on a DNA molecule. Now, the moment you get into something even minimally more complex, such as, for instance, things like transcriptomics and like metabolomics, so trying to find data about how certain genes are expressed within particular tissues, that's when it becomes much more difficult to have these kinds of dissemination because, for instance, the temperature under which the experiment was performed tends to generate completely different results if it varies. And so there's so many different parameters that people need to be very careful with when they're producing the data that actually there are big question marks around how, you know, how much can you really rely on these comparisons. So, and then, of course, with genomic data, the interesting thing is that the more research has been done on how sequencing actually works, the more people are starting to realize that actually, even in sequencing, you cannot really entirely assume the standardization works. So lots of cases where you actually sequence the same sample over and over again, and you actually get significantly different results even there. But let's just say that in the case of genomic data, the variation and the degree to which you can question comparability is much, much less than for lots of other data types where environmental factors become more prominent.
Yeah, so if you were to kind of maybe just draw a line under or a conclusion from this, I mean, so big data is changing scientific practice. You mentioned the fact that governments and funders are, I guess, very keen on the construction of databases and the generation of infrastructures that facilitate the use of data, but then again, scientists mightn't be fully on board or incentivized to do this. So how do you think big data is changing scientific practice? If we discount, let's say, the optimistic arguments that it's going to lead to this comprehensive set of data that we can then mine for useful correlations and acknowledge the fact that it's not a complete data set, it's going to be biased in various ways, and have maybe limited utility, well, how exactly then will it change and make contributions to scientific practice?
Well, I think there's two interesting developments here which really make this a relatively novel situation. One is really this acknowledgement of the prominence of data as scientific commodities, and in fact as social commodities in general. I think this really is historically a new thing. So, of course, people have done a lot of, you know, research that one could characterize as big data research in history. I mean, an obvious prominent example is the use of is natural history in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, where people were collecting lots of specimens from all over the world, analyzing their characteristics and trying to provide different taxonomies to discuss organisms. I mean, that, you know, could easily go under the heading of big data science. And of course, in meteorology, you find lots of other examples of that. So, you know, in that sense, that's not the novelty. But the fact that you're acknowledging that publishing data in themselves as a research output is of value. Now, that is a relatively novel thing. Because after all, even the first journal ever created in science, or at least the first recognized as such, which is Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, was based around publishing claims. So basically arguments made on the basis of data, not the data themselves. So until now, data have actually been the kind of thing that you maybe add to supplementary information to your paper, or you may want to discuss with your colleagues, but there was no obligation for scientists to really share their data fully. In fact, there's been a lot of issues around that. And that question wasn't even regarded as in any way relevant by funders and any other players in the governance of science. Now, this has changed dramatically, and this has come together with another change, which is in the methods, the infrastructures, and the skills that people now use to handle the data. And of course, in that sense, the advent of information technologies has played a very key role. Now, I think that the ways in which this is changing science is not so much by directly affecting the epistemology of science. It's not that now people think of causality in different ways, I don't think. I don't think people have a different way of sampling, and I don't think people are using correlations differently. In that sense, I'm really against the kind of arguments that have been made around the power of big data. Where I do think that this is changing science is by generating a very explicit debate among scientists around the ways in which they're handling data. And this is very, very important because that debate has always existed to some extent, but very much as a side to the scientific enterprise. It was never institutionalized. There were never official fora where people could exchange their perspectives on this. And people were never really forced to declare to funders and to publishers how they handled their data in detail. So the fact that you now have this explicit debate is generating a lot of changes. You know, there are people who are now very favorable towards trying to publish their research journals, for instance, and their lab books, and the ways, very in a detailed way, the ways in which they produce the data. And there are more and more efforts to really think about, you know, the expense and the investment that goes into producing certain data and what it means in terms of then integrating it with other data. There is a revaluation of the expertises that go into data production. So people who have been classified until now as being mere technicians are now being recognized and actually, in some cases at least, making a serious contribution to research because they're making very specific decisions around what potential uses a data may be subjected to. So in this sense, I think we're seeing a really transformative situation. And this is why the European Commission has launched the Open Data Policy Platform and there have been all these initiatives around what used to be called Science 2.0. And the reason is really this, because this approach to data and data handling and the importance of empirical evidence for research is transforming the very way in which science is done and in some cases actually what counts as science in the first place.
I mean, do you think that, you know, the recent controversies around like the replicability crisis in particularly in psychology and concerns about the non-publication of null results, are they linked to this debate about, you know, changing the attitude towards data? They're not really consequences of big data infrastructures, but are they part of this kind of shifting culture in scientific practice?
I would certainly argue so. And in fact, that's what I'm writing about these days. So I think there is a very strong expectation generated partly by this emphasis on big data and particularly open data, that it should be possible to replicate the data. And in fact, one way to measure whether you've chosen the right parameters as metadata to go with your data is the fact that you can then reproduce an experiment and be able to replicate your data. So I think that's very much in the background of what is happening now. I mean, after all, there has always been problems in replicating results in science. So I think that explains why this has now become such a big issue. You could have done these kinds of studies at any point in the history of science. So why now? And why is it now becoming so prominent and so talked about? And, you know, again, I think there's a sense in which what we've seen in that debate is still many, many assumptions being made about what kind of data are the most relevant and how they should be treated. So very often the idea is that, you know, particularly if you're dealing with quantitative data, then it should be just straightforward how you replicate them. If you don't manage to replicate them, then you haven't done your job properly as a scientist. And you know, and that basically is one of the reasons why qualitative data, for instance, are so much more inferior to quantitative data, because qualitative data, almost by definition, are data which are very tied to the specific situations where they've been produced, and they're very difficult to interpret unless you take that into account. Now, I think, and you probably will see that coming, given the type of arguments I'm making generally, I think that hopefully should shift. So I think that, in fact, the ways in which people are treating qualitative data and having to be very, very careful about signaling the provenance of that data and the condition under which it was acquired should really be becoming a model for thinking about replicability in the natural sciences. And in fact, you know, I'm sometimes puzzled by the insistence of replicability within psychology, because, of course, on one end, it's very important to give enough elements to your readers and to people who scrutinize your work to be able to replicate experiments, to be able to see what you've done. At the same time, it's quite clear that in at least some of the situations, the actual material conditions under which you perform that experiment are basically impossible to reproduce. Whether it's because you have a particular type of human samples, whether it's because you were in a particular institutional situation that is not going to be possible to create again, it's just a very difficult expectation to put on researchers. So what I'm hoping is that this whole discussion around replicability will become a fruitful way to people, for people to reflect more constructively about what it means to evaluate the quality of data, and in fact how important it is to acknowledge that different data sources will have different weaknesses and different limits, and it's not always possible to replicate them perfectly, and it's not always possible to compare them in a way that's straightforward.
Thanks for all of this. I just want to maybe conclude with two observations of my own, and I'll let you respond if you like. The first is just that one thing you've highlighted here is how science at the moment seems to be embracing this culture of transparency, the need for the data to be open and revealed in order to ensure the kind of legitimacy of the scientific process in the eyes of the public who consume and are affected by scientific results. And it seems to me that this is also a lesson that perhaps is being and should be learned by other users of big data mechanisms. So this is something I've argued about quite a bit, that mm-hmm. openness and transparency of those systems may also be essential to ensure their ongoing legitimacy. And lots of people have argued this, so I'm not claiming any novelty. So I think there are ways in which we can learn from what's happening in science. The other point, just the last point I wanted to make, was that one thing you highlight in your paper, which is important, is that in biosciences, the kinds of data that are collected are maybe heterogeneous and messy initially, so it's much more difficult perhaps to construct databases. But in other contexts, it might be true that the data is less heterogeneous and less messy. I'm thinking, you know, collecting information from tax returns in order to use some algorithm that will find out if somebody is a likely tax fraud. I mean, that data is much more kind of generic and non-diversified. Yeah. I guess the only problem is that people are often adding different databases of information to that to generate other kinds of predictions about people's behavior. But there could be differences between what's happening in the biosciences and what's happening in other contexts that would be worth thinking about and focusing on as well.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very interested in that, so it'd be great to continue that conversation. I mean, I would say, indeed, as you already hinted at, there is a danger in thinking that just because a data set is being collected under rather obvious and straightforward situations, then it couldn't be used in ways which are problematic. I think, you know, and partly that's the reason why I'm fascinated with the biological sciences, because they're so heterogeneous and that effort is being made all the time to integrate different data sources. I think that's by and large what is happening now in the public sphere in trying to make arguments about how wonderful it would be to put together X data source and this other data source, data about tax returns and data about people's kind of ways
social,
of living and kind of,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly, or kind of housing situations in different parts of the country, that kind of thing. And I think we're almost unavoidably going towards a situation where more and more claims will be made on these kinds of intersections. And that's where I think the arguments that come from looking at the sciences really need to be made also in the public sphere, because the same dangers will be incurred there, and the consequences of, you know, disregarding critical assessments of the different sources of data will be much, much greater in that respect. Say, in that sense, I mean, another thing that worries me a little bit is, you know, on one end, of course, I agree that more transparency is very, very important. At the same time, again, I don't think transparency is the only solution here, because we are looking at very, very complex spaces where it's impossible even for people like me who are spending their whole time trying to track down who owns what, who produces which data, where do they go. We just cannot do that anymore, because these spaces are so nested and so interdependent that it's very, very difficult. Even if you have, I mean, even if all the information about all these different data sources is there for you to pick, it's basically impossible for any one individual to make sense of it on their own. So the question becomes, you know, what space is there, for instance, for regulation on these kinds of issues? What space is there for serious discussions around ownership and intellectual property when it comes to the dissemination of personal data? You know, when it comes to what kind of aggregates of data do we allow and which ones we think actually really need to have some professional and expert scrutiny, these kinds of things.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. I think as one of my colleagues put it before, the assumption that transparency and openness will lead to a better governance or a better situation rests on a fantasy of abundance, the belief that just abundant information will make everything better, which isn't true. So, yeah, I'd like to thank you for joining me for this conversation. I think we'll draw to a conclusion there. I'll be sure to put links to the work that you've been doing and the work that you're doing as part of your ERC project as well. So, yeah, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.